derivative. I have three ways that I think of the derivative. What's more convenient for my understanding or for me trying to finish a proof, I use a different one of these three equivalent definitions. So if one of these three things is true, they're all true. If one of them's false, they're all false. Okay. So three equivalent ways of thinking about the derivative. Okay. One, you've probably seen it like this, maybe written with a delta x or with an h. Last time I asked, h was more popular. What do you think? Would you rather see a delta x or an h?
H.
Yeah. I don't know. It's like, no one ever says, I really want the delta x. No. Maybe some. No one has really spoken up for it yet. Something against Greek letters, maybe. Okay, so we say that the derivative at A equals M if, when we take this limit of slopes, you get M. Right? We have the usual picture. Rise and a run. The run is just h, and the slope is the rise over the run. And we take the limit as h goes to 0 to get a tangent line slope, right? Capture it with this equation, a little limit statement. Now, if you just represent the variables ever so slightly differently, you get something that's not conceptually any different, but sometimes algebraically this makes doing a proof a little bit easier. So instead of thinking of it as we have A plus a little something, we think of it as we have a number x that's getting close to A, and we measure the slope between two points where at one place we just input A, at the other place we input a variable x. Okay. These two are really the same. It's just a modulo, some notation really. The x is A plus H, right? So if you substitute, and if X is A plus H, then X minus A is the same as H. So these two things are the same. And if you get really technical, you have to say something like, well, the limit as H approaches 0 of A plus H is A, and you, so by continuity or something. And the limit as x approaches a of h is 0, because h is x minus a. It's not very interesting. Now the really truly different one, to my mind, is the third one, where you think about approximating the curve by the tangent line. So the third way to write it is the limits of a function. Think of it as an error function. So this error function represents the difference between the tangent line and the actual curve. So, pull the picture here. It's the vertical difference between your tangent line and your curve. So we want that thing to go to zero. Okay. So what does that look like? Looks like this. But it's not enough for it to go to zero. It has to actually go to zero in a sense fast. It looks like it goes to zero quadratically. So what you actually want is you want x minus a, right? You want this error here should be not just small, but actually it should be a small multiple of x minus a. So let's write it. Okay, so we have So this is the tangent line, right? Or the linear approximation, as it's also called. And then you have plus a little bit of error, right? And I think the book likes to keep this term all inside the error function. I like to have the error function explicitly as the ratio. The idea is the slope is m plus a little bit of error. See, there's an x minus a factor. So the actual slope between two points is actual rise over run here from x to a is m plus this little error. That depends on where you are. And you want that error to go to zero. And these all say the same thing. I won't bore you with a really formal proof of why they are equivalent. I'll just indicate the main idea. One is equivalent to two because you just have, on the one hand, x is a plus h, and that goes to a as h goes to zero, and on the other hand, h is equal to x minus a, which goes to zero as x goes to a. And why is 2 equivalent to 3? If you take this equation here, this equation here implicitly defines the error function as this, it's the solution to this equation. But if you write it explicitly, right, the error function is exactly the difference quotient, as it's called here, the slope by measuring two points minus that limiting slope, right? If you solve this thing for the e of x, that's what you get. So this e of x, as I wrote here, it's the actual measured slope that you get between two points on the curve, and then you subtract off that limiting slope of the tangent line, and you get this error in the slope. Okay. So you might call it the slope error. That's not a standard term, but helps me think about what it means. Right? This represents how much your slope measurement is off if you just use two actual points instead of taking the limit. And so this error is supposed to go to zero. Well, the error is going to go to zero if and only if this limit really is m. If this fraction tends to m, then over here, this thing will tend to zero if and only if you've got the first part tending to m, so you'll get m minus m. Here, m minus m equals zero, right? If and only if. What do I usually do? I usually write the double arrow for if and only if. So we need this thing to go to m to get the error in the slope measurement to go to zero. So there are three ways of looking at the same thing. And depending on what you're trying to do, what you're trying to prove, one or the other may be more useful. Well, practical applications of the derivative involve the linear approximation. You approximate your complicated real-world noisy data by a line, right? Just because sometimes even the curve is too complicated to deal with, even if you have a formula for it. But you need to pretend it's a line. And if you zoom in and it's really differentiable, then making it a line is a good approximation, if you're close enough. Okay. So, let's say I want to do a basic proof here. F of 2 equals... Okay. Where f of x equals x squared plus x minus 7 directly from the definition. So I can use whichever one of these versions is most convenient for me, 1, 2, or 3. Say I use version 1. So let's take a limit as h goes to 0. Okay. So we have f of 2 plus h minus f of 2 divided by h. See what we get. Okay. 2 plus h squared. Okay, so do some algebra. What's 2 plus h squared? That's 4 plus 4h plus h squared. And then 2 plus h. Okay. So that's the value of 2 plus h. Now subtract off the value of 2. 4 plus 2 minus 7. H, I forgot, I need to have a little more room in there for my limit operator. As h goes to 0. And you may have seen one of these before. There's some cancellation that works in our favor. Okay. The negative 7s cancel. What else cancels? The 2s cancel.
The
4s cancel. And the stuff that doesn't cancel is all multiples of h. What doesn't cancel? There's a 4h, an h squared, and an h. Okay. Now, crucially here, when you take a limit, you're talking about stuff that happens as h gets close to zero in this case, but not making any promises about what happens at exactly h equals zero. So this is undefined if you try and plug in zero exactly, but for any other real number, it is perfectly well defined. This is why people introduce that sometimes annoying technicality into the definition of a limit of a real function as the input approaches a particular number. That technicality of, well, as the input gets close to such and such a number, but not equal to it, the output gets close to blah, blah, blah. You have to have that technicality in here. Otherwise, these derivatives don't make any sense, right? Because you'll always have the 0 over 0 in the good case where the derivative exists, but that's not what you want, right? You want to ignore the 0 over 0 that you get if you plug in exactly 0. Just take the limit as we get close to but not equal to 0, okay? So the limit as h goes to 0 of f of 2 plus h minus f of 2 over h radically simplifies to just the limit as h goes to 0 of 5 plus h. And we believe polynomials are continuous, so that means we can just plug in 0, because this is a polynomial. So we're done. You may or may not have had some professor that made you prove some limit directly from the definition back in Calculus 1. But that's what honest proof of it looks like. Now, let's use version 2. I think that for proving, say, the power rule, at least for positive integer powers, version 2 is a great way to do it. As long as you remember something about geometric series. If n is, say, one of these numbers, a natural number, starting at 1.
Here's the power. So we're going to take the nth power. I guess I need one more thing, right? So let A be any real you want. Right?
The polynomials are, I claim, well, I haven't got all polynomials yet, but at least the powers, the positive powers, those are different. Can prove the power rule. So I'm going to use version 2 here, f of x minus f of a over x minus a. Now here's my trick. I'm going to remember something about geometric series. General, it's just a root algebra fact. Okay. So looks like this. Let's see if we get it here. So there's a bunch of stuff. So this is just a pure algebra fact. Multiply both sides by x minus a, you'll see that everything cancels except the first and last terms. Just consider what happens. Multiplying both sides by x minus a will not change the truth or falsity of this equation as long as I'm not multiplying by 0. So as long as x minus a is non-zero, the truth of this equaling the numerator will imply the truth of the fraction equation. And x minus a is not 0 as long as x is not a. So what is this? Multiply by x, right? You get x to the n. And then the next term is x to the n minus 1 times a, and then x to the n minus 2 times a squared, and so on, all the way until the end, you have x times a n minus 1. You see the pattern is the power of x is decreasing by 1 in each term, and the power of a is increasing by 1 in each term. And that's multiplied by x, and then you have multiplication by a. A, you get xn minus 1 times a plus xn minus 2 times a squared plus xn minus 3 times a cubed. You go all the way to the end until you get to a to the n. And the last stuff cancels. X to the n minus 1 times a. This cancels with that. This one cancels with that one. What about this one here? Well, that one cancels too, but I didn't show it. It's over here in the dot, dot, dots hiding, right? And what about this one? This one cancel? Yeah, that one cancels. It's the next term here in the dot, dot, dots. I just didn't write it. Everything cancels. This last term here matches the second to the last term in here. follow a pattern. The only stuff that doesn't cancel is the first term here and that very last term over there. So it's just pure algebra. The alternative to doing it this way, if you want to do it with the H, is you use the binomial theorem, and you have to look at all the terms and count factors of H and so on. Anyways. So this is just pure algebra. And the key is now there are n terms here, right? The powers of x go from n minus 1 down to 0 powers of x. Similarly, the powers of a go from the 0 powers of a all the way up to n minus 1 powers of a. 0 through n minus 1, that's n numbers. So when you take the limit as x approaches a, since we're not plugging in x exactly equal to a, just x close to a, but different still, well, we can use this little algebraic identity here. Okay, and then as we take the limit, this here is a polynomial. Okay, so we can just plug in an a for each of the x's. And when you do that, we see that we actually get a to the n minus 1 every time. A to the n minus 2 times a, that's a to the n minus 1. A to the n minus 3 times a squared, a to the n minus 1. All n of our terms are going to be a to the n minus 1 in the limit. So we just get n times a to the n minus 1. So we have the power rule. Any questions about that?
What if I want to prove something more abstract? So if f is differentiable at a, meaning f prime of a exists, so the limit over that, one of those limits over there actually exists, then I claim the function is continuous at a. Now, this is most easily proved if you use the linear approximation version over here. Okay. So, one version of continuity is just proving that when you take the limit as x approaches a, the values f of x tend to what you get if you plugged in exactly a. I'm missing a verb. We will prove. Okay, we're going to prove that. Okay, so let's see what happens. We have the linear approximation. So we have the y-coordinate at exactly x equals a plus this term for
telling how the tangent line moves up and down as you change x, and then plus the slope error times the run x minus a. So we have this limit, right, by definition over there in version 3, right? The slope error tends to 0 as x approaches 3. And what is m? Well, m is the derivative of a. Right? So that's so I'm assuming it's differentiable at a, and then I'm using the linear approximation version of the definition. Okay, so now it's really easy. Just take limits. What happens as x approaches a? Well, let's see. F of a is a constant. M is a constant. Let's see, x minus a, that's just a polynomial. It's going to go to a minus a, which is 0. And we can use the limit laws where we can break this up, right? It's this limit, it's going to be the limit of this, plus the limit of the middle term, plus the limit of the last term. The limit of the last term is going to be the limit, well, the product of two limits, right? So we have f of a plus m times a minus a plus the limit of the e to the x, a slope error function, which is 0 by definition of differentiability, and then this x minus a goes to a minus a. Okay, all the a minus a's are just 0. So what do we get? F of a plus a bunch of nothing. Okay, so the limit of the outputs as x approaches a is the output when you plug in exactly a. So differentiability implies continuity. So you can see that if you hadn't had the third version of the definition, you would have had to basically invent it anyway in order to do that proof. You would have had to take this equation or this equation, and you would have had to solve it for f of x or f of a plus h, and then you would have gotten exactly this kind of formula. So each of the three versions has its place. Doing what you're trying to do, different version is easier to think about, easier to reason about, easier to do algebra with.
Questions? Problems?
Yeah.
Where do you get the a minus a from?
X is approaching a, right? So this is x minus a, so just plug in a. Because it's a polynomial. X minus a is a polynomial. So it's continuous. You can just plug in a. Plug in a. The only place where you can't simply plug in a is the e of x, right? We don't know much about e of x, but we know enough. We know it goes to 0. But all the other stuff is just polynomials. So you just plug in a. Everywhere there was an x, an x minus a, I just changed it to an a minus a. It's just a polynomial.
Other questions?
Checklist here. Trying not to forget anything important. Okay, so those are the three versions. Differentiability. There's other things that you can do that are pretty easy. So for example, a constant, how about the constant 1? Its derivative is 0 everywhere. That's trivial. Take the limit as x approaches a, and the outputs are always 1 and 1, right? Now the key here is that you're not plugging in exactly a, right? You're always plugging in something close to but not equal to a, and getting closer and closer but never reaching it. So the denominator is never 0, but the numerator is 0 all the time. And the limit of a constant is just that constant. Okay, so the constant function where you always output 1 has derivative 0. Yeah, no surprise. We graph y equals 1, it's a horizontal line, the slope is 0 everywhere, the tangent line is the same as the graph. Nothing interesting there. Okay, so you want to bump this up, right? You want to show that all polynomials are differentiable. So we just need to be able to put polynomials together. We've already got the powers. We've got x to the n. We've got one of the constants. We've got 1. So I guess you can think of that as the zeroth power. But how do you put things together? You have, say, 5x squared plus 7x or something. So you multiply a power of x by a constant, then you add it to another power of x multiplied by a constant. So you need to know that that process doesn't break differentiability. Okay? Well, that's easily proved. If I have, say, f of a is L and g of a is m, f prime of a is L and g prime of a is m. So if I have these two functions have derivatives at this input a, and then say I have some constants, c and d are real numbers, right? Then there's no problem with the derivative. Okay, so here we go. Let's say I want to multiply f by c, multiply g by d, take the derivative of that, you'll get exactly what you expect, c times L plus d times m. How do we prove this? It doesn't really matter whether we use the H version or the X minus A version. Let's say I use the H version. Okay, so C of F, C times F plus D times G at, say, A plus H minus C of F, C times F plus D times G at A, all of that divided by H. Just move up here since it's getting kind of crowded. Well, that's just going to equal, just factor it out, right? Group-like terms. We equal C times, so C times F of A plus H. And then factor out the like terms with the constant D, right? And you'll have G at A plus H and G at A. And what is this going to tend to? Okay, so this is something you can handle with the limit laws, right? We have the sum of two things, right? So we take the limit of this part and the limit of this part. If they both exist, we can just add them together to get the limit of the sum. Okay, so this thing is going to go to C times F prime of A, right? You use the product limit law, right? The limit of this is just C. The limit of that is F prime of A. The limit of this is d, because it's d is a constant, and the limit of this fraction is just d prime of a. Well, what did I say those were, right? Those are L and M. So, sum rule, if you make C and D 1, this is the sum rule for derivatives. You get the derivative of F plus G. Make C 1 and D negative 1. You've got the difference rule. Make C whatever you want, make D 0. You've got the constant multiple rule. I should make a little remark here about notation. Okay, so it's an unfortunate thing that our notation for function application looks a lot like our notation for multiplication, right? Right, so right here, I'm not multiplying by a plus h, I'm applying the function, right? There is right there. I'm applying this function. I'm applying that function. And you could say more about the notation, right? So, for example, again, this trips people up. So I think it's worth mentioning. Right. This is the function. Right? This is not a number or anything. This is the function, right? And it's defined by doing what you would hope it does. If you have input x, then what you do is you multiply f of x times c and add that to d times g of x, right? So yeah, there's a lot of notation potential for confusion. Sometimes we choose the notation such that the application is as close to multiplication as you can make it. And so you can blindly use the distributive property here and you won't get the wrong thing, right? But it's a little subtle, and sometimes the notation makes it even subtler. Beware. So, okay, given one derivative is zero, so it's differentiable everywhere. Given the powers, they're differentiable everywhere. And now given this way of putting functions together, we can say that every polynomial is differentiable everywhere. Because we can just move. What's a polynomial like? It's going to be a bunch of constants, each constant times the power of x, right? Up to some highest power where we quit, right? So you can repeatedly use this constant, multiple, and sum rule here to break this up. Until you've broken it up into terms that are just constant multiples of powers of x. And then each power of x is differentiable. The constant c0 is, you can think of that as c0 times 1. Right? And then, of course, the derivative. Right, we know what this is going to be. C1 plus 2C2X, right? All the way to eventually N times CNX minus 1, right? So polynomials are differentiable everywhere. You start with 1 and the powers, multiply them by constants, add them up to get your polynomial, and then just from these rules, it works out to be what you were taught.
No big surprises there.
And the big rule, I think, is the chain rule. Super important. Takes a while for people to get used to it. They don't learn as quickly as the power rule normally. So this is
here's one way to state it. If the relevant derivatives exist, then the derivative of the composite function exists too at the trip.
Let's recall, again, this is more function notation, right? The little circle means composition. Okay? Apply G, then apply F. Okay? So we're saying that the derivative of a composite function is given by this formula. How do you prove that? Well, the best way to do it, I think, to handle all the cases, is with the linear approximation method. That's not the intuition that leads you to it. Intuitively, you think of it as, okay, you've got a change in f divided by a change in x, right? And you want to factor it out as a change in f divided by a change in g. And so the change in g divided by the change in x factor here is going to tend to the derivative of g. And then this factor here, you think of g as being the g outputs as being the inputs to f, right? So your inputs of f, the change in them, you're comparing that to how much does that change f, and the ratio should tend to the problem with this reasoning is, what do you do if delta G, the change in G, is zero? That's what goes wrong. But in terms of my notation here, I mean, I guess f of x minus f of a, I'm using the x and a version as opposed to the h version. That's the tricky part. I mean f at g of a minus, well, compared to f at g of a. So that's the idea. But as I said, there's an issue with delta g being zero that you have to deal with. The way to deal with it is to use the linear approximation formulation. Show you the pictures here. Yeah, I got that.
To avoid this problem with the factoring argument where the delta g might be zero, right, because g might not pass the horizontal line test, we use the linearization, the linear approximation method. Right? Let's see how this goes. I guess our first error function, and I'll call it E sub F, right? So this is F of X is equal to F at G of A. Okay, so I'm computing the tangent line of F not at A this time, but at G of A. Now maybe I should put this on a separate line. It's going to be a long line. Actually, we don't even need to say let. By hypothesis, the derivative exists, right? You can say we have this. And where the limit, so as x approaches g of a, we get this limit. And so we have the slope of the tangent line times the run, x minus g of a. Okay, so z a is g of a, because we're going to be plugging g values into f. And then we have the error term. And we get a similar, we get a similar thing. So because of this derivative, we got that slope error going to zero. There's a different slope error going to zero for the g derivative. So we have e, I'll call it e sub g. So this will be the slope error for g when x is near a. This is going to be g of a, and that'll be the output value at exactly a, plus then the linear term, because we're thinking as a tangent line. So we have the slope of the tangent line times the run, x minus a, to tell us the rise we need to get to the appropriate place on the tangent line. And then we have the little term that represents the error in the slope. As we get away from the tangent line, and the slope of the curve may be different. So I have these two linearizations plus the errors, and I need to put them together. So we have f of g of x now. Okay? So we're going to replace the x here with a g of x. Everywhere we see an x, we're going to put a g of x in there. Okay.
And if we want, at some places, we could replace the g of x with its own linearization plus error formula. So right here, see the x minus g of a? I'll put a little star to indicate that I'm going to use the linearization of g right here. Okay, so right there, I used, see these three terms here, the x minus g of a becomes this by, I'm plugging in a g of x there instead of an x, and I'm replacing the g of x with its linearization, and the g of a cancels. Just get this, and then there's another error term. This error term. But now I have to go to g of x, and then this thing here. I could replace it, the g of x here with the linearization, but I don't have to, because I'll still get the limit I need if I just leave this as g of x. So you see everywhere there was an x in here, it became either a g of x, or after it became a g of x, I replaced the g of x in the one crucial case with its linearization, to cancel out that negative GA there. Let me get all this. And what happens now as x approaches A? What do we get in the limit as x approaches A? Okay. Well, let's see. Maybe I'm going to have to take that back. Maybe I'm going to have to use the linearization on this one as well. So you get the slope you want, f of prime at g of a times g prime of a times x minus a plus a bunch of other garbage, right, which I'm going to collect into this term. Okay. So what's that other garbage? You'll have f prime at g of a times e of g, and you'll have e of g times g prime of a, and you'll have e of g times e of g. But the key is that everything except the value f of g of a can have an x minus a factor. using the linearization of G. So what is that variable? That last error term. We need to make sure it dies.
Yes, it did.
Maddock, the author of the recommended textbook, couldn't bring himself to actually do this proof. He didn't think it was pretty enough, I guess, because he gave the intuition, and then he said, we'll handle the case where you might have division by zero in the exercises, right? I could have made you do this as an exercise, but I didn't think that was a good idea. Okay, so with all that, where the leftover garbage that we want to show goes to zero, what is it? So that is, we got to be. So we have f prime and g of a times the e g, the error function, the slope error function for g near a. Then there's three other terms. The next term is the error function g times g prime a, and then the last term is error function g times itself. So these terms. So remember, we had the slope we wanted, f prime at g of a times g prime of a, which came down here. But then there were these three error terms. Right? Maybe I can label them. One, two, and three. Right? These three ugly things. And the point is, now as x approaches a, I claim all this goes to zero. Okay. E of g will go to zero, because it's that's the slope error, right? By assumption, right? It's going to go to zero. Not this one. Well, that's just another E of G. Oh, look, everywhere there's an E of G, we're good. Now I'm going to go zero. So we get a. So we got this nasty error function from the. Using the chain rule and the linear approximation definition and derivative and putting two linear approximations together. But all of the three pieces of extra garbage, they go to zero in the limit. What limit? As x approaches a, right? Because they all have an e of g in there somewhere. There's one place I'm commit a little typo here. Fix that. Where did I make it? Into that. That go right here. That's supposed to be an e sub f. See the e sub f here becomes that's it, that term here needs to do that. So it's e of f and g of x, but don't worry, it still goes to zero. Now you can see why Maddock didn't want to write this proof. Pain to dwell the details. Okay, but it's true. The chain rule is true. And if you actually do the details, it still all works out. Okay, so there's one little thing you notice here. Because here, the E of F, I didn't say the F slope error went to zero as X approaches A. I said it approached zero as X approached G of A. Well, fortunately, as x approaches a, g of x approaches g of a. So you will get this thing going to zero. But how do I know that? Well, I know that because g is differentiable at a, and we show that differentiability implies continuity. Finally ends the proof. So the chain rule is a big one, and it's hard to actually give a correct proof because of all the potential divisions by zero that the really desirable, elegant, intuitive argument unfortunately is vulnerable to. But if you lose the pretty fractions and make it the ugly linearization plus error format, then there's no more divisions anyway, right? It's all just multiplications. And so you don't have to worry about that problem. Okay, what other rules? Very important. Product rule. So I'm fast running out of time. I'm going to contain myself with mentioning some rules, even if I don't prove them. Okay, what's the product rule say? And you've probably seen it. Save it for next time, the rule about inverse functions. It's in chapter 14. Okay. You have two functions differentiable at the same point. Then the pointwise product function is also differentiable there. And you know the rule. F prime times g plus f times g prime is the derivative of the product. And so again, there's potential for confusion of the notation. So f times g is the function that you get where if you plug in x, to F and plug in X to G and multiply those outputs, that is the output by definition of F times G. It's the quick proof. It's in the book. Good. Have time. I need to give the homework. Okay. It's not hard. I can do it next. I can do it on Wednesday. I can clear it on Wednesday if you want to see it.
Just like I can do it in verse 20.
So, prove the reciprocal function is differentiable at every x except 0. Initially at every a except 0. Better notation, better. Directly from the definition. Right? And two, so use your result from one and combine that with the product rule and the chain rule. Prove the quotient rule. So you know the quotient rule about f prime g minus f g prime all over g squared, right?
Okay.
Well, you can think of f divided by g as f times the reciprocal of g. So, do that. And yeah, now I'll have to let you go. I can prove more stuff next time if you want to see it.